KZSU, Stanford University. I don't know how you can't love the Kinks. I do. Welcome to show three of Hearsay Culture. I'm Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. And today's show is going to be a discussion of an area that I think will have particular interest to people who are listening to this not live, because today's discussion is going to involve the interesting and challenging world of podcasting. Podcasting is something that is a relatively new phenomenon. I think my guest, Colette Vogel, who I will introduce more formally in a moment, would say it probably started around 2001, as best as we can pin it. But podcasting is kind of the corollary to what I'm doing right now on radio. It's a modern way to have audio communication, and I will allow Colette, the expert, to discuss it in more detail. Hearsay Culture, as those of you who have listened thus far know, is a show designed to discuss technology issues from the perspective not of the lawyer, which I am, or of the geek, which most of the people who know me would say I am, and which I'd probably say I am as well. The goal here is to really discuss these issues in a way that is going to broaden the horizons of those who don't live it every day. Colette is someone who will be very good at discussing these issues because she has recently authored, along with a couple of colleagues, a legal podcasting guide. In fact, the exact title of it is Podcasting Legal Guide, Rules for the Revolution. Colette is an intellectual property attorney and heads the firm Vogel & Associates, where she advises clients on a variety of legal issues related to technology, new media, and the arts. She also holds a non-residential fellowship with CIS, where I'm a resident fellow. In fact, I'm not sure how it would exactly play out, but I either took her position or Chris Sprigman's. I'm not sure. But she is a non-resident fellow with CIS, where she co-authored the aforementioned study. And what is going to be the topic of discussion today? So when we get back after a short musical break, I will put Colette on the air as I control her destiny for the next 40, 45 minutes or so, 50 minutes on the air. And we'll have what will be a pretty wide-ranging discussion of exactly what we mean when we say podcast. Elvis Costello, The Angels Want to Wear My Red Shoes. Before that, The Kinks was a dedicated follower of fashion. And I think that title, at least, segues into welcoming Colette to the air. Welcome. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you so much, Dave. It's great to be here.
It is my pleasure. It's been fun to interview CIS colleagues, and I think today's it's certainly easier. Last week, or a few weeks ago, I interviewed Jennifer Granick. But Colette, thanks for coming down here today from sunny San Francisco. Why don't you?
Not quite that sunny today.
Yeah, that's what I heard. You know, I use that phrase loosely. I think certainly as compared to where we are at Stanford, it's
the eternal bliss here.
That's right. Well, why don't we start off for listeners who are not intimately familiar with podcasts? Why don't you define what it is and why it's called that?
Yeah, that's sort of two distinct questions. Basically, at its very root level, a podcast is a digital recording, and it can be a sound recording, just audio alone, or it can be audio and video, like a little video that is done digitally. That recording is then transferred to a place on the web, and listeners can go find it. And if they like what they're hearing, watching, they can subscribe to it. And it's really this publishing and then subscribing model that makes podcasting really unique. That's really what it is. It's just a different way for people to receive their content, and they get to receive it in a little more of a on their own time schedule, which is one of the things that I think makes it such an interesting medium. And to answer your second question about where the word comes from, it comes from the combination of the words iPod and broadcasting. And I find that to be a little misleading as a term, because it's not really a broadcast in the traditional sense like what we're doing today in the studio. And it's also not necessary that you own an iPod in order to enjoy a podcast. You can enjoy them on a a computer of any kind, pretty much, as long as you have internet connectivity. And you don't even need an iPod brand MP3 player. It's, you know, you can listen to it on many, many kinds of devices.
So it's a wonderful thing for branding from Apple's perspective that we call it podcast.
I think they're not upset about that.
Has there been any effort? I'm not familiar with it, but has there been any effort to try to change the name, or are people getting offended by using podcast when they don't necessarily use Apple equipment or software?
No, I think it grew up at a time when audio blogging was one term, video blogging or vlogging is another term, and vlogging is actually used fairly commonly as well. Somehow podcast seems to be the thing that people most easily grasp, but vlogging, I don't think there's really much of a difference, at least on the legal side, in terms of if you're vlogging or podcasting. The thing about vlogging is it's very clear it's video, it's not audio. The podcast word alone, you don't know if you're talking audio or both, something that's video and audio. In fact, this weekend there's a VloggerCon conference in San Francisco, and they use the term vlogging. They don't go after, you know, they're not marketing themselves as a podcasting conference. Mm-hmm. So
it's one of those words that has multiple meanings depending on what we're talking about at a given moment.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about this legal podcasting guide that you've authored?
Sure. It's called The Podcasting Legal Guide, Rules for the Revolution. And I had the great opportunity to do this year as part of my non-residential fellowship, and wonderfully had the opportunity to work with a couple people in bringing this out, because it turned into a much bigger undertaking than I think I originally thought. Mia Garlick at Creative Commons, who's also a non-resident fellow at Stanford Center for Internet and Society, and I, we discussed this in its early stages, and she offered to help with some of the aspects of it, and she did a tremendous job in helping me. And we also received a lot of assistance from the Harvard Berkman Center, their cyber law clinic, and Phil Malone and Tim Armstrong were instrumental from the faculty side, but I know some of their students also did a lot of the work on the music rights section in particular. Anyhow, this grew out of seeing all of the benefits that the EFF blogger guide created last summer. In the summer of 2005, they produced that guide and was a tremendous resource for individuals who can't go out and get formal legal advice on every little thing they're doing. They're hobbyists mostly, or people who care about citizen journalism and things and want to make sure they're doing the right thing, because this form of content distribution makes it so easy for anyone to distribute their ideas and their thoughts and their creativity and their art and whatever. It's important for those people to also get some base level of education about what they're doing in an intellectual property world for the most part, but there's other areas where people could use advice on that.
And now, when you mentioned, I want to take a step back a second,
sure.
As you mentioned this collaborative effort, it really seems like there's a ton of organizations involved in this. How did, give me a step back, and I think maybe we're getting into it, but why did this come about? You mentioned a previous edition, or not of your journal,
no.
but of something different.
Yeah.
What's led to the point where you thought and your colleagues felt it was important to have a document like this?
It really was seeing how useful the EFF blogger guide was. And the thing with podcasting is, I think what makes it a little different from some of the technologies that have come before it, and how it's grown up, it is the thing that I think people are going to gravitate towards en masse, more than blogs. Blogs requires text, and the text, you know, requires reading, and some people don't like to read, but a lot of people watch TV and listen to the radio, and this is going to go into that area. People are going to receive their content more and more on sometimes small devices, a telephone or an iPod or another MP3 player, and this explosion that we're on the very early stages of media distribution and content distribution opens the door for things to really change in the balance of how media is distributed, who controls what we get to see. And so from sort of a theoretical standpoint, it's a it's a remarkable place we're at. And I thought, you know, this guide that EFF did is brilliant, and there are some things that are missing from it that could really help the podcaster, because it deals with what do you do with music, with audio and music, and what can you do, what can't you do? What does the average user who wants to take clips from their favorite television show and critique it, you know, can they do that in a video podcast? Those things are very, very important, because people can open themselves up to some pretty significant liability if they're not careful. And because of that, this sort of coming explosion that I think is happening in the audio and video content distribution area, and also seeing how valuable what EFF had done is, I thought this is the thing we could really use getting out there. And it was great to get other people who were like totally thought the same thing and wanted to see the information out there and available for free. So
right, yeah, and that's one of the interesting challenges. You know, your podcasting guide is chock full of good legal information, but also has some interesting history. In section 3.1, a very, very brief history, as you call it, I think you cite a stat which is just remarkable, and one that I really wasn't fully aware of. But according to your report, in September 2004, a Google search on the word podcast resulted in 24 hits. And this next number blows my mind. You said in at least as of January 16, 2005, the same search resulted in 115 million hits.
Right.
That's incredible.
Right.
What do you account this exponential growth? Is it the ease by which someone can create a podcast? Is it the fact that it's a great way for people to be able to exercise their First Amendment rights and let information out there? What's your sense of the reason for the growth?
Well, I think it could be something that sounds astonishing to you and me. I don't know exactly how old you are, but I know how old I am. But if you think about the people who I think this content or this type of content distribution is most attractive to and who are glomming onto it the quickest, it's the IM generation, the instant message generation. And they're used to getting information quickly, getting it in the format they want it, getting it where they want it, and being able to interact with it. One thing about blogging that is so interesting is that people can comment, people can respond, people want to respond to the author and be engaged in it. So there's really a drive. I was at a conference at the beginning of May, the Always On conference called On Hollywood, and it brought technology and Hollywood people together. And a statistic that Tony Perkins put out there that shocked me was that the average 21-year-old kid, which basically is the heart of this IM generation, of that group, 62% of the content they read online is generated by somebody they know.
Wow.
So that's an astronomical number. I wish I tracked Tony down to find out again where he got that statistic, but he put it out there, and it was sort of the buzz of the whole conference.
Right.
But the thing is, podcasting means you, I, any kid who has a band or has a poetry they want to read or has something that they want to discuss and debate with their friends, the debate club, whoever it is, they can put it out there and people can listen to it. And if they like it, they can respond to it. Most podcasts have an online presence such that people can respond, people can comment, people can clip them and put them in their own podcast and just debate it and whatever. So there's this generation of people who want to interact with their media and want to be part of the debate, and they don't just want information fed to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason why I think this is such an incredible format for what's going to happen in the future. That's why that number, I think, is so big.
It's an incredible number, and certainly anyone following these issues has read about MySpace and places like this where
Correct.
Children and teenagers are able to, you know, interact with each other in a relatively unmoderated environment, which creates other issues.
Right.
But from the podcasting perspective, you know, one thing that occurs to me, and it's funny for me to say as someone who podcasts himself, but how do people, first of all, get the time
right.
to listen to all of this? My wife, who I will credit with the following question, said to me, she said, you know, who are listening to these things? And then secondly, And I think you've answered that question. But the second question is, how do you pay attention to these blogs and podcasts and websites? And, you know, is there an information overload that podcasting is contributing to? Or I suspect your answer is going to be, but I'd like you to get your response and elaborate on it. Is podcasting adding something new and dynamic to this dissemination of information? You mentioned the idea that people may want to listen as opposed to read. And I could certainly see personally the idea, which I've done, of downloading a podcast and then listening to it in my car. But what's your sense of that, the timing issue and the use of resources?
Yeah, I'm overwhelmed myself, and I'm sure many other people are, with the number of things you can do with your time and the sources of information between where do I get my news, where do I get my music, all of the sports, all of those things. It's overwhelming. So there is this is a problem in how the media industry is going to change. There needs to be search-related components so that if you're interested in certain topics, it's easy for you to get to a podcast, and then you can see which podcasts or which topics, which content is the best. And the interesting thing about that is, in the past, there's always been an intermediary between the content creator, the artist, the writer, the radio host, whoever, and the public. And it's been a management level. It's been a distributor. It's been a radio station. It's been, a traditional publisher. And that person provided a layer of editing that weeded out a lot of the stuff that they didn't think was good enough for the airways and for people to get. And so what you received in the past is something that may or may not have been at a higher quality, but it was certainly had gone through some levels of weeding out. And now the person doing the weeding is gone. Mm-hmm. It could be gone. I mean, it's not totally gone. That's an exaggeration. But how do you get to the stuff you like? And it just takes some patience, I think. It takes some talking to people. There are different resources online where, podcasts are made available, and you just kind of have to pick and choose. Mm-hmm. And then think about when it's great to listen. I personally the car is like such a waste of time for me. If I'm not able to talk to somebody on the phone, other than maybe listening to some music on a CD. So now I'm able to listen to podcasts that relate to my work, which is a great use of time. You know, it's content that isn't on my radio station. And so I can plug in and listen to a speech or a presentation or something that I missed and has been made available through download. Stanford's website has a great number of talks and things from lectures that on all sorts of topics that I'm like interested in, but don't have time to be at.
Right.
And then the other place I've found personally to listen that was wasted in a way before is when I go jogging. If I go jogging for 45 minutes to an hour, I can listen to two or three short podcasts or maybe one presentation. And, it's kind of sad because I used to listen to music in that time. Now I feel like it has to be filled with business. But,
right.
It's amazing when you change the question to when do I want to listen? And then it's possible to listen at those times.
It's kind of a time shifting situation.
Exactly.
that we've dealt with previously.
Yeah. I think that answered your question, but
I think it did. When it comes to things like podcasts, this is the purpose of exploring these issues. We're talking about something which your report suggests started, what, 5 years ago, roughly. And, your guide, and I want to get into a little bit of the content on the legal side of what you're talking about after the next music break. But setting the scenario, it's very clear to me that every time I go on iTunes, and literally, and I'll check it because as I've said, most people know me would call me a geek. I will check iTunes almost every day, at the risk of my marriage. Heidi, my wife, who's listening, will probably be nodding in agreement, but I do check to see if there are new podcasts that I might be interested in. And there's usually one that I can say, I might want to listen to this. And then my next decision is, do I really have time to subscribe to another podcast? So it's an interesting challenge. Before we go to the next break, mm-hmm. I kind of want to just kind of get a very top level answer to this question. Your guide itself,
mm-hmm.
who is it designed for? Who are the obviously podcasters would be interested, but are there any other goals you have for creating a document like this? And like I said, I'd like to get into some of the content on the next
sure.
break.
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to answer that. The real audience for this guide is somebody who's thinking about podcasting or podcasting now. It's written in very not too overly lawyered of a way.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that people who don't have an opportunity to go out and get their own legal advice can at least glance at this and get a sense for what the big issues are that they should be thinking about. I'm sure there are other people listening or reading it or taking a glance at it at the, you know, companies and corporations that are starting to use podcasting as a way to reach their clients and customers. I'm sure some of them will come upon it in their research, but they'll probably hire somebody to really tell them what to do. So the real audience is to give really good advice to people who are stepping into this foray. And some people might be a little shy because of the, all of the RIAA lawsuits against file shares and stuff. And people might be nervous. This is a new technology. Am I going to get in trouble or whatever? And so this is hopefully to lay the land and give people a sense of what the minefields are. Now, I have to say, a lot of the advice in the guide is fairly conservative. And we might talk about some of that in the next segment. But
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, it's what the law is, and from a conservative standpoint, how we think you should, what we think you should know and know the risks you're taking. It's not the way the law should be, in my view. I mean, there are a lot of things, you know, that would be a whole nother discussion about what we should change about primarily our copyright laws, to allow for a little more flourishing of information, but.
Well, I think, and that's an area which is rife with controversy, but also a great topic. And I think I'll say, you know, at the bottom of the hour before we take the break, that I'd love to have you come back and talk about some of those things. I will before we take the break. I wanted to just kind of quote from Professor Lessig's foreword to your guide, where he said, and I think this will be a jumping off point when we come back. He said, for the first time, its regulation, the it being the regulations on creativity. Reaches far beyond commercial creativity and instead burdens non-commercial or amateur creativity, where amateur means not second-rate or inferior creativity, but instead creativity done for the love of creating and not for the money. And that regulation now threatens one of the most important new venues for citizen speech, podcasting. That's a quote from Professor Lessig, and I think as we come back from the music break, I'd kind of like to pick up from there and see what your podcasting guide says about those issues and the law that tailors I don't use the word brilliant often, but that is the brilliant Nikolai Dunger, Dr. Zhivago's train. We're back. This is KZSU Stanford. I'm Dave Levine with Colette Vogel on Hearsay Culture. Colette, at the break, I was starting to get into some of the content of your legal podcasting guide. And at the end, by the way, I'd love to hear generally about where the podcasting guide can be accessed for people. But tell me a little bit about you identify three kind of top-level areas of law that you felt were, and your colleagues felt, were the most important areas for podcasters to know: copyright, publicity rights, and trademark law. Why don't you give me, a brief summary of each area in terms of what the core fact is about those areas of law that podcasters should know?
Okay, yes, happy to do that. I should say that those are the three areas that needed some elaboration from the EFF Blogger's Guide, because that guide does cover defamation and other important issues that anybody talking or writing or producing content about other people needs to be a little bit aware of. But anyhow, yeah, on the three areas, copyright, publicity rights, and trademark law, the lion's share of the guide is devoted to copyright, and that's partly because the laws right now are very convoluted. Maybe not convoluted, but they're very important and being, stretched in ways that I don't think were originally anticipated when we originally came up with some copyright laws. And in the area of copyright, the key things that this guide talks about are music rights and what happens with video and putting sounds to images, basically. So there's a lot of complexity if somebody wants to distribute content that includes traditional record company labeled music, and the rights and the way to clear those rights for the, you know, average hobbyist or amateur is so complicated and difficult to and costly to mm-hmm. achieve that one thing the guide does to help alleviate some of that is point people in the direction of what's called pod-safe music. It's music that the creators and the copyright owners have put out in the internet stream, so to speak, in a format and with a license that says it's okay for you to copy this for your own personal use or for non-commercial purposes, and in some cases for commercial purposes, images and sounds. So it's a way for people to, you know, use sounds and images in a, without having to potentially violate the rights of another entity. Now,
let me interrupt sure. you quickly on the copyright. So copyright law is the primary focus of the guide, and it's also been generally the biggest issue I think that people have faced in technology when it comes to the interaction of intellectual property law. I've written about trade secret law, and there are people who, right. plenty of people writing about the impact of patents on software patenting and stuff like that. In your before we briefly talk about the two other areas, I was curious to get your thoughts. As you researched this guide, did you get a sense of how aware people are generally of copyright yeah. law, given the fact that there have been so many high publicity lawsuits dealing with music downloading? And in a couple of weeks, I'll be interviewing Joanna Demers, who wrote a book about Steal This Music, dealing with these issues. But what do you find when you talk to podcasters? Mm-hmm. How familiar were they prior to this guide? Mm-hmm. With the law.
Yeah. There's, by the way, that book, the Steal This Music book is great. I'm looking forward to listening to that show. But, I spoke at a panel last November, at the Portable Media and Podcasting Expo, and that was a great opportunity to meet a number of podcasters. And the questions from the audience, they had two different panels dealing with copyright. One was strictly dealing with music issues, and the other was a more general panel that I was on with Denise Howell and a few other people. And everybody knows there's this 800-pound gorilla called copyright law that they need to deal with. It's rare that somebody comes up to me and says, I've never heard of copyright. What is it? But they don't know how it applies and what it really means. And that's what this guide tries to explain. One thing that the guide does, and does hopefully pretty clearly, is up front tell people, here are the things you can do and the ways you may use even copyrighted content legally. And it lays out five instances where you don't need to run out and find somebody to get permission. Beyond those five ways, and some of them are, you know, like fair use, which is sort of a wishy-washy thing sometimes, beyond those, we live in a permission society where you need to get permission. So people know that there's something there, but the getting into the details of it has been very interesting, and we had tons of questions at that conference.
I would imagine that this is an area that's almost complete mystery to most people, simply because of the fact that the law itself is so esoteric. First of all, it wasn't really something that was overly relevant to people prior to the advent of this technology being so widely available,
right.
and the fact that it's law.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, we this isn't the first time we've had this sort of an issue. And again, this would be another program probably. But, you know, the player piano, the videotape recorder, the copy machine, each kind of new technology had to get kind of stretched and considered within the context of copyright, it seems like. And this is sort of one of the latest flavors of that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's been a shift, though, in some public perception on what they're willing to do and not do.
Now, what about, very briefly, publicity and trademark
sure.
rights?
Publicity rights come up mostly, well, only when a podcast or someone creating the content is using images or sounds, likeness,
images, signature, things like that of another person in their individual capacity. And when that happens, you need to have that person's permission if you're doing it for commercial purposes. That's a very broad statement. and right of publicity is a beast related to state law. There's no federal standard, one size fits all for the country. It varies state to state. And in California, as you might imagine, with so many people needing to control their image and things like that, from an industry standpoint, the laws are fairly well developed. The guide recommends that if you're interviewing somebody for your podcast, that you actually get their consent. It would be ideal if you had that somehow in writing, so they couldn't later say, hey, you used my voice and you didn't have my permission, and now your podcast's being sold, or now your podcast's on a page website that has advertising and things like that. I mean, those are stretches of the law, but I think from a very conservative standpoint, it would be wise to have that. I think if you can't do it in writing, just get it in recording before you go on. I think most podcasts are longer than what ends up in the actual podcast. You've recorded more information than you're actually going to have in your final cut. So part of that early, it should be your routine practice. Get the person to say, yeah, it's fine with me if this gets on, if this is on a commercial site, or this, if you use this for your podcasting efforts.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that when you're talking to podcasters in terms of the demographics, that more and more people obviously are getting involved in it, even though the information itself, as you mentioned, podcasts are being accessed more by people who are younger, who are more familiar with the technology? Are you finding that more and more people who have no familiarity with podcasts, would never consider doing one, are nonetheless accessing this stuff? Or is it still, are podcasts still kind of almost talking to each other?
That's a good question. I mean, I know I have a bunch of statistics about the number of people with iPods, the number of people who've downloaded a podcast, and projections to 2010 for the number of people who will be listening. In the end, there's definitely going to be more listeners than producers. And the best produced productions will start to rise to the top and will get snapped up and syndicated, and they'll get actually paid and all of those things. Mm-hmm. I think there are certainly a lot of people who listen and don't create. Or watch and don't, create.
From your guy, this is kind of the Dave Letterman type late night talk show question. But what's the most counterintuitive rule that you found up when you did all of this research? And I have to say that, I've read the guide, and I couldn't find anything that, I might have a question about that wasn't addressed here. But what rule, when you were doing the research, did you think was going to go one way, and then once you looked at the law, you found out it was going in an entirely different direction? I'm sure there are many, but maybe just to give the listeners an idea of what we're talking about here.
Well, I do have to say, partly because I've practiced in the copyright field for so long, I mean, the rules, it's hard to remember what was so counterintuitive when I started. But this was one of the first times I dug very deeply, as deep as I could, into audiovisual works and what is protected and under what licenses you can use other people's audiovisual content. And I learned about videogram licenses and master use licenses and things called sync licenses. And I find that area to be extremely complex. And some of it draws from tradition. When you had theatrical releases as well as television or broadcast releases, the copyright owner, usually the movie, the MPAA, basically like the movie company or whatnot, they would splice up those rights. Here's the theatrical release right. Here's the broadcast right. And they allow the rights get split out in a way that makes them the most money. But in a podcast, I don't know for sure. I mean, I think the advice in the guide is conservative, but I don't know for sure if, it's not a theatrical release and it's not a broadcast. So do you have to pay this license? And, I think people need to be aware of it. And that's an important area, but it was new to me in a lot of ways, and somewhat counterintuitive that these rights are still divided this way.
It seems from looking through the guide that podcasts are really part and parcel of a larger confusion in the law about what we do with these new creative works. And what strikes me about podcasts as opposed to, say, a blog or something else is that you in many ways have more opportunities to potentially violate the law. If you take a podcast and, you know, your guy talks about taking a speech of someone else's and using that speech in a way to do kind of commentary or what have you. I was doing some research today with, just trying to see what's out there, and I came across something new. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about this area. That's why I wanted to do this show, and that's why technology is so exciting, because pretty much every day I can find something that I didn't know about. So I was surfing several blogs. One of my favorites is Andrew Sullivan's blog, which he calls The Daily Dish, which now I think he does through Time Magazine. I'm not sure. At any rate, he just today, and this is posted today, the show is airing June 7th, posted an entry which he called Podfisked, F-I-S-K-E-D. And what that is, how he defines it, I'm quoting from him, it's a podcast version of a fisking. A fisking, a term derived from the many times bloggers have dissected the deranged writing of Robert Fisk, is a genre that takes a text by someone else and responds to it sentence by sentence, point by point. So what did Andrew Sullivan do? He took President Bush's speech from, I guess, last week regarding the same-sex marriage amendment and spliced it with his own commentary. What do you say about that? I should say it's always a good thing to say when you're talking to an attorney that I'm not asking for legal advice, and I know you're not offering any legal advice. But what's your reaction to a podfisk?
Yeah, I find that to be totally entertaining, and I'm thoroughly thankful to you for showing it to me today earlier in the day. It was very funny. That particular example obviously has some First Amendment rights that may not attach to every type of podfisk. But it's so interesting. But what I love is that it is people doing something creative and having a comment and having an interaction with their media. It's what the IAMers love doing. Mm-hmm. And I know Andrew Sullivan may not be an IAMer, of course, from that generation, but legally, there might be some questions. You know, a speech is a copyright protected matter. I mean, not when our president's speaking, but mm-hmm. you know, if somebody else is making a speech, and if you then take that and splice it up, you might be making a fair use because you're commenting, you're criticizing. But if you're doing it for commercial gain, I don't know. Maybe there's some risk there. But there's been some interesting fair use decisions recently, and I think that area is going to be worked out and, you know, slowly with our legal system. Mm-hmm. But I found that example to be really one of the great examples of what you can do with this media and have fun with it.
It's hilarious, you know, and when I came across this, I mean, aside from the substance of it, which isn't, you know, a topic that we would discuss here, it reminded me of some, you know, things that I did when I was in high school doing high school radio. On the way over here, I mentioned to you, but I think it's funny, you know, back in the late 80s when I was in high school, I would take lyrics of a Madonna song and then splice those lyrics with my own commentary on air. But it required me to set the turntable, stop and start the turntable, make sure that my buddy, you know, these two, you know, 10th graders were making the right, you know, button pushing and whatever else, which hopefully I've figured out. But it's the rudimentary effort that now has become podfisking. So it's, you're right. You know, you mentioned earlier about this not being the first time we've had to deal with these things, and it seems like it's coming around.
Right.
With the last couple of minutes we have left, I have a couple more questions.
Sure.
And you started alluding to it, but give me a sense of where you think this is going. Where is the law going in this area? And asking you to read tea leaves is never a fair question for lawyers. But you know, from one litigator to another, I'll ask it anyway. what's your sense of where the law is going, and where do you think we're going to be, say, 5 years from now, with a guide like yours?
I would say, Yeah, that's a tough one, but I will give it a shot.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? Maybe I'll be right. The guide is going to be updated periodically, so the guide will move along with what happens. And I think from a technology and business standpoint, this is taking off. I mean, I've been to enough conferences and talked to enough people to really believe that this is a way people are going to want to receive their content. Eventually, it will all come to our cell phone, I'm told, but also. So be ready for your cell phone to be really, really souped up if it's not already. I mean, mine's woefully out of date at this point, so I need to get a new one. But it's going to happen. This technology is going to be used by many, many, many people, either as a listener or a receiver, a listener, a viewer, whatever, or as somebody who wants to make use of it for their speech and for their sharing of information with their close friends or with the world. Companies are using this to talk to their employees. Companies are using this technology to connect with their clients and their customers in ways that you could never do before. Training videos can be sent this way. It's just an amazing thing. So the media is going to stick around and it's going to continue to improve. The law is going to respond slowly, and it's going to take some time to ferret out real claims and real issues with issues that are kind of no-brainers. And I liken this a little to what Google has been facing with this fair use battle. I mean, that's a big battle, and it's an important one, and there may come a day where there's something in a podcast that leads to that kind of an issue. I know that there's been some movement in sort of the fair use realm and sort of trying to explain to the world and figure out what is fair use, what boundaries are there, and there's been more effort to defend fair users who then don't have to just scurry away and pay a license because, you know, they don't have the resources to fight that battle. And mm-hmm. and I think there'll be generally some pushback on people who are overreaching on their copyright interests. And that will be very interesting to see the developments of. Sometimes because I'm in the middle of this world, I think it's a bigger deal. I don't know what the, you know, it's like outside the beltway thinking. I don't know for sure, but that's what I believe is happening. And I would like to see some more balancing done.
Well, I think there's a lot of people who are out there trying to make those efforts, and I think I tend to agree that the law itself is facing it's at a crossroads right now in terms of what we want it to do. And I think as more and more people are aware of both the strengths and the limitations of the regulations that we have, we can more fairly craft it. I think in the absence mm-hmm. of information and absence of basic knowledge about what's going on, of course, you know, stymies any effort to change the law, mm-hmm. You know, or change anything that currently exists. This has been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed having you here, Colette. Why don't you, what would be very helpful, of course, is tell people how they can access the podcasting legal guide and also how they can contact you.
Okay, thank you. The guide is available in a number of places. First off, you can get it from my website, which is vogellaw.com. It's VogelLaw.com. Right on the homepage, there's a link. The main, the link goes to Creative Commons, and they have a wiki where you can get onto the web version of the guide.
The wiki is for the uninitiated.
Sorry,
that was
a little techie.
Yeah, yeah, no.
it's a place where content can be placed online and made available for people to respond to it and give commentary and things like that. So if you want to comment there, you can. You have to register, but they're a very nice organization. They're not going to do anything once you've registered. You can just get in and say things if you want to comment or ask questions. And then it's also available at that website by download in a PDF format. And you can also get it in a print format through Lulu, which is lulu.com, and they have a print-on-demand system. And we're not getting any royalties from that. The cost is 5 $5 and some change or $10 and some change if you want it in black and white or color. I like the color one better. It looks really nice. But anyhow, Lulu has it in print version, and also the Center for Internet and Society, where I'm happy to be a fellow or a non-resident fellow alongside Dave here. They have a copy of, they have the links to it as well on their, on the website, cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And, yeah, and then I just wanted to say one little thing. There's a ton of conferences coming up this summer that I'm going to be at, and I'm hoping to see some of the listeners at, or hope that people will come to. The first one is up this weekend. It's VloggerCon. It's June 10th and 11th in San Francisco. I'll be at the Corporate Podcasting Summit in 2 weeks on June 21st, and I will be at BlogHer, which is June 23rd and 24th.
And how do you spell that? That has a funny spelling, I think.
BlogHer is B-L-O-G-H-E-R, right. And I misspoke. It's July 28th and 29th, and GnomeDex is June 23rd and 24th.
Well, Colette, thank you so much for coming in and for discussing your podcasting legal guide. It's clearly an invaluable resource, and I think the fact that we could definitely go another couple of hours discussing the law indicates its extreme need. So thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you.
I do invite you to come back. We're coming close to the top of the hour, so rather than do my usual music break before coming back, I think I will close the show. This is Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. Today with me was Colette Vogel, a non-resident fellow of CIS discussing podcasting. We are going to hopefully have several weeks of uninterrupted programming every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I have some great guests coming up in the coming weeks. David Olson, my colleague, resident fellow, as I do the rounds through CIS, will be discussing the bizarre world of patenting. Professor Demers will be on to discuss Steal This Music. Christoph Engemann, who is a non-resident fellow, will be coming on to discuss.
Christoph's great.
Yeah, he's terrific, and we're lucky to have him here stateside. He's going to be coming on to discuss national identification cards. And then several other people are going to be coming in the coming weeks, but those are the next couple of weeks. So, again, my name is Dave Levine. This is Hearsay Culture. You can tune in every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m. Coming up at 6 o'clock, we have Brownie in Motion as we return to the music world. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the rest of your evening.